My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Guys,
we're going
to see a dead body.
Sometimes that is better.
Welcome to an extra special star-studded bonus episode of the King Cast. The Long Walk is currently in theater, so it's high time we brought you the audio from our big San Diego Comic-Con panel. This was recorded this past July. Bresnikan and I hosted this panel with a bunch of the stars and the creative folks from the movie. And you're about to hear all that stuff. Now, not only are you going to hear the audio from the panel, but we also got to sit down with the same group in the very noisy green room afterwards to talk about some Stephen King shit. I'll be back to introduce that part a little bit more in depth. So let's get right into this panel discussion, shall we? So what you're about to hear, Stephen King himself kicks off the audio. He did a taped introduction to the panel that introduced the latest trailer. You're not going to get the audio from that. You don't need to hear it. You've seen the trailer. You've probably seen the movie at this point. And then the next thing you're going to hear is an actor dressed up like the major from the movie. They had him come out and like address the audience. I guess he was there to pump up the 6,500 people there in Hall H before Brez and I enter. So you're going to hear him run his spiel, doing his major like speech. And then we're going to come out and we're going to introduce the panel featuring writer J.T. Mulner, producer Roy Lee, and actors Garrett Werling, Tut Nyot, David Johnson, and, of course, Mark Hamill. Enjoy.
Hey, it's your old pal Steve King here, and I'm here to introduce the new trailer for The Long Walk. So I hope you're all doing well there up in Hall H. And I want to say that I thought of this book when I was 19 years old, and Vietnam was just hotting up there at that time, and we were all concerned that we were going to end up slogging our way through the jungle. And so it was a long time before the Squid Game and Hunger Games. So enjoy the trailer, and I hope you go see the movie. It's got some hard bark on it. Take care of yourselves.
Luck to all those who signed up for the long walk. Stay seated. And remember, hint 13. Conserve energy. I look at each and every one of you, and I see hope. We did the very first long walk all those years ago to inspire and reintegrate the value of work ethic in this country. Now, the rules boil down to this. Maintain a speed of 3 miles per hour. Receive 3 warnings or step off the pavement and you will get your ticket. The goal is to last the longest. There's one winner and no finish line. Walk until there's only one of you left for the chance to claim more riches than you could possibly imagine. The task is simple. Walk or die. Anyone can win if you refuse to give up. Now, who's set to win? I said, who's ready to win?
Hello.
Hello, thank you, Hall H. My name is Anthony Bresnikan. This gentleman is Mr. Eric Vespi. Eric,
hello. Look at that, I got a fan club here. Who would have thought?
You win, man. Why are we here?
Well, we are the hosts of a podcast called The King Cast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. Thank you. Thank you very much. So they needed some Stephen King nerds up here to talk about their Stephen King movie, and we gladly obliged.
Yeah.
We are so psyched to be here, especially to talk about this movie. And
on our show, we bring creative people on. They talk about their thing, the thing they've made, but also their favorite Stephen King story, their connection to his work. Who here has read him or loves Stephen King? All right. This book was written before Carrie, before The Stand, before The Shining, before Salem's Lot. He was 19 years old when he finished it, a sophomore in college. He submitted it to a writing contest, and they said no thanks. It sat in a drawer for like 10 years. Then what happened?
Well, and then he became established, and he decided to publish it under the name Richard Bachman, along with other stuff, The Running Man, which is also getting a new adaptation this year.
Running Man. Richard Bachman, rest in peace.
Yes, he's been long dead, probably for the better. His stuff is very dark, as we will be talking about on this panel. You want to start?
Well, but this we should say, Uncle Steve kind of referred to this in the opening video, but this was written before reality TV was a thing. There were game shows.
That's true.
But there wasn't any Survivor or Fear Factor, certainly no fictional adaptations like Squid Game or The Hunger Games. Steve doesn't feel like they ripped him off. He's just like, you know, everybody's continuing their own story, and the idea of people who are in desperate situations having to compete for survival, that goes back to the caveman times.
It does. And so we have, you know, the long walk questions, why it has to be, you know, that this story is still relevant today. And I think it's still a question worth answering and asking. And in order to help us do that, I think we're going to bring some folks up on the stage to help
us
do that.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to begin with the screenwriter of The Long Walk. And you know him from Outlaws and Angels and last year's Strange Darling. He is recently, as of yesterday, announced to do another King adaptation of The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, J.T. Molnar.
Yeah.
End of the show. And the next person up, we are going to be bringing up a producer who has had his finger in just about everything scary that you've loved in the last 20 years, including a lot of Stephen King stuff. We're talking It, Salem's Lot, Dr. Sleep, not Stephen King, but The Ring, Grudge, Barbarian, producer Roy Lee.
Now for our actors, he plays Stebbins, contestant number 38, Garrett Waring.
Yeah.
Woo. We also have Arthur Baker, number 6. Please welcome Tut Nguyen.
Yep.
He is Peter McVries, number 23. You know him from Alien Romulus, David Johnson.
I think there's at least one more person involved with this movie.
He's a good one.
He's the big bad of this movie, the major who keeps them all marching. He's also Stephen King's online bestie. You'll see him on social media bantering with Mr. King all the time. He's also unforgettable in the recent The Life of Chuck as Albie Krantz. He's playing a slightly different character this time out. He's an actor who's been coming to Comic Cons for over 50 years now. First time was with a space movie, I think.
There was some obscure space movie he was in.
Yeah, I don't remember the title. It escapes me. But ladies and gentlemen,
I'll think of it.
Mark Hamill. Yeah. I wore a Stephen King hat. He had to one-up me and actually go, no, good sir, this is a Richard Bachman tale.
Yeah.
I think we want to start with JT and Roy, because this is, I don't know if you guys have been as obsessed with following Stephen King stuff as much as we have been, but The Long Walk has had a very long road to the big screen. There have been people from George Romero, Frank Darabont, Andre Overdahl. There's a lot of people who tried to make it and couldn't quite do it. So I'd like to start with them and ask them, like, what was the secret sauce this time out? What made this the version that finally crossed the finish line?
I'll let JT speak, because it was the screenplay that got the movie greenlit. And this was like the fastest movie that I've gotten, one of the fastest, from the time of starting development to wrapping the movie was under 2 years. And it was, a lot of it was because of the screenplay.
You're breaking Frank Darabont's heart.
Thank you, Roy. It happened because of a really special confluence of elements that came together. And Roy Lee is a magician. He knew I was looking for something to write coming off a film I directed. He also happened to know Francis Lawrence. And so he knew that I revered Stephen King and loved this novel. And when he asked me if I was interested in writing it, I had to meet Francis, who wanted to direct it. And when we met, we just got along so well, and the movie he wanted to make was the movie I wanted to write. And shortly after, I mean, we delivered the script, and we heard Stephen King liked it, and then we heard that Lionsgate liked it, and we got to go into production shortly after. So it was a magical experience.
Can you think of anything specifically from the Bachman book that you felt it was necessary to preserve to tell this story? Everything that's adapted gets changed, but was there anything that he wrote that were from his words that you were like, I got to catch that spirit, or I got to use that line, something specific you wanted?
Well, what I do first is I go through the entire book, and I read it a number of times, and I underline things that I want to keep, dialogue I'd like to keep, moments I'd like to keep. And the biggest challenge here was the fact that I just underlined so much. It's a really great book, and it's miraculous that he wrote it at that age. But we had to lose things. So in the end, it wasn't something specific, but I wanted to keep, and Francis wanted to do this too. We wanted to keep the DNA and the themes that Stephen King had baked into his original novel. And even though he was writing it about specific things at the time, I feel like the relevance is generational. And so I wanted to make sure we had that beauty and that love and a story of friendship and characters, and also brutality and hopelessness and terror.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because I think fans of the book are wondering, all right, Hollywood gets its hands on this story. Are they going to tone it down? What can you say to people who are worried about that?
No. Francis and I, once again, I'm a director too, and sometimes the idea of writing for somebody else can be nightmarish. In this case, it was a dream, because when Roy introduced me to Francis, he told me he wanted to go all the way, you know. And I knew that Stephen King wanted us to go all the way, and I knew Lionsgate wanted us to go all the way. So it was one of those things that I knew we could be honest and faithful, you know. And if this book got into the wrong hands, the wrong studio, the wrong filmmakers, it could have been neutered. You know, and I'm very, very grateful we were able to keep the teeth that the book has. This film definitely has teeth.
We heard Uncle Steve in his videos say the movie has hard bark. Does it also have hard bark in addition to teeth?
It has hard bark.
What does hard bark mean?
Is it hard bark tea?
Yeah, hard bark, and definitely it definitely has bite, and it needs to. It would be unfair, and I think it just wouldn't work on so many levels if we didn't go all the way. And it's a unrelenting, brave film, I think, with brave performances and you know, heavy, exciting, terrifying themes. Mm.
Well, I think for some folks in the audience, they might only really know the trailer so far, so I'd like to introduce them to your characters. So let's start with Garrett. And can you tell us a little bit about Stebbins? What is Stebbins? How does he stand out amongst this group of young men?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I just want to say, how cool is this, y'all? I mean, you sacrificed your time, your effort, your money. You got time off work. You flew across the country to be here. I am so happy to be in this room with you guys amongst some
dear friends. I love
you,
Garrett.
Thank you, guys.
I love you, man.
This blessing does not go unnoticed to me, and I'm so thankful. I am immensely proud to be sitting amongst four incredible actors, producers, and writers. This movie is awesome, and I can affirmatively say that. Our script was amazing. Francis Lawrence, who directed The Hunger Games, absolutely amazing. And Stebbins is, in the book, a very complicated character, and that does translate to the screen. JT did a great job at kind of making Stebbins pop in the way of thinking, why is this guy so mysterious? He's hiding something, and fans of the book will know why. But, yeah, there we go. So, throughout the film, we're wondering, why is this guy keeping so much to himself, right? But why does he know so much about the Long Walk? And we follow this mystery throughout the course of the film, and I think that makes it a very enticing character to play. And unfortunately, some way along the walk, I come under with an illness, and it's fun to watch that unfold as well.
Yeah,
he's really good. He's really good in the movie.
Yeah,
I want to reveal a little something that happened just backstage before we came out here. So we all come downstairs in an elevator, all the actors and JT and Roy, and then they see all of the soldiers in the glasses, looking intense. And you guys were all kind of freaked out. You're like, why is this getting under my skin, right? It was a freaky movie to make, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, whenever we would have a death on set in the book and in the movie, they would do this air horn. And every time I've heard an air horn since then, it was like this response that I've had. But there was a time in my life, we had this major character up here doing this monologue, right? There was a time in my life where I could repeat that monologue to you verbatim because of how many times sweet, sweet Mark Hamill said it to us on set. They had so many different setups. We shot that scene for about a week, that intro scene, and I'm sure we all could memorize that by the end of it. Yeah.
Well, we hope Lionsgate's paying for some therapy for
yes,
for
yeah, exposure therapy
and a massage for my feet.
So tell us about Arthur and how.
Oh,
Arthur has a fan and Todd has a fan. Tell us about Arthur and what distinguishes him among this group of young men.
Yeah. Hello, everyone.
Hey, Todd.
Yes.
What Garrett said, we're very grateful and everything. Thank you. And it's such an honor. It's my first time in America, which is crazy. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Art Baker is, you know, grew up dirt poor in Baton Rouge. He's a religious fella. You know, he mentions that a lot through the movie. I think he's a very grounded person. And, you know, he's a lovable character. I think he holds everyone together. And, you know, the journey he goes on, I think it's really beautiful. And it touches, you know, who we are as people. You know, the fear, the, you know, our beliefs, you know, what we believe about others, you know, because I know that's heavy in the movie. But yeah, he's just a lovable character, and you know, I remember reading the script and just flipping, thinking, wow, like, this is real, you know, and the character of Art Baker is just perfect in my eyes. Yeah, so thank you, yeah.
Yeah.
And may I say one thing about this boy? You may not know his name yet, but my God, will you? And he is brilliant in this movie, and I'm so proud of you, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is so cool to be here with you. And if you thought David was good in Alien Romulus, wait till you see him in this.
Yeah. Well, that's
Eric,
the thing about...
Sorry,
that's the thing about this story, though, right? You'd think that this would be a competition where they're out, you know, to sacrifice the others because everybody who's on this walk is in the way of the ultimate prize. But that's not what the story is. It's a story of support and love. And you can't help but love these guys when you're watching the movie or reading the book. And so you actually feel it when they start not making it. And I think that that's kind of underlined, really, in the relationship that, David, you have with Cooper Hoffman's Garrity, that Peter McVries has with Garrity. Feels like the heart of the movie. Is that how you felt it when you read the script?
Yeah. Yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, everyone. Hello. This is my second Hall H, and honestly, I'm going to do the same thing that us wonderful boys have been doing. This is awesome. This is so nice. Thank you guys for coming to see movies and supporting movies. I feel honored to be a part of it. This is awesome. Thank you. In answer to your question, I do think it's the heart of the movie in many ways, but I also think this movie has so many other beating hearts, like the relationship between all of us boys, and you know, a lot of a relationship between like the government, you know what I mean, and establishment. I think Stephen King is just an auteur in writing things that end up becoming timeless, and things that we need to just, like, you know, have in the back of our head. But yeah, Cooper, who plays Raymond Garrity, is just amazing, and we developed a very, very tight bond that I think lent itself quite well to the movie. So,
all right.
Let's hear it for that. That brings us to Mark Hamill and the Major. They love Mark Hamill.
Love you right back.
Mark.
Who?
George, on Sunday.
Oh, good. Hi back.
Mark, tell us about the Major. You grew up in a military family. Yeah. That's what Francis Lawrence told me that when he spoke to you about the part. You said, I know this guy. So yeah. Who is he?
Well, I did my last 2 years in high school at Yokohama High in Japan. And even though my dad was in the Navy, we were on the Marine base. And I'd walk across the parking lot seeing the officers putting these guys through their paces in blazing hot sun, and they were just brutal, barking orders, and you know, I mean, I'm telling you, things that you never want to, you're sorry that you remember, like if you vomited, they forced you to eat it. Ugh. Yeah, I saw that. I hid my eyes. It was horrible. But when Francis talked to me, I said, I know who this guy is because I've seen him firsthand. And the premise itself is so off-putting. It's like, I don't know if I can even see this movie, much less be in it. But what happens is I can't remember in which order, but I read JT's script, I read the novel. And the premise is just a device to get you to the real heart and soul of the movie, which is the experience of the walkers in these extraordinary circumstances. And I was just blown away by the performances. So good. I mean, you know, see a lot from these guys over the years. I saw you in Alien, but everybody else, except for, I guess, Roman Griffin Davies, I'd seen him in Jojo Rabbit and Cooper in Licorice Pizza. But for the most part, totally unknown, but just amazing performances. I have to tell you, they're to be in two different Stephen King projects the same year shows you what a versatile writer is, because you couldn't get further away from The Long Walk than The Life of Chuck. It's hard to believe the same man wrote both these stories, neither of which have any supernatural elements at all. So sometimes he's unfairly categorized as a horror writer when, as you pointed out, he's done Green Mile and Shawshank Redemption and The Body, which became Stand By Me. He's just fantastic. And I have to tell you, when we went to the Toronto International Film Festival, they said, you're going to be sitting next to Stephen King. And outwardly, I was like, hi, how do you do? Inwardly, I was like, oh, my God, it's Stephen King! But I didn't do that. You know, I just didn't. I restrained myself. I didn't fanboy all over the place. But I wanted to ask him so many questions, and I thought, well, this isn't the right time. Well, the first thing that amazed me is when I came up, before I even said, how do you do, he said, the Major. I thought, how did he know?
He has his ways.
Yes. Well, I asked the Lionsgate people. They said, oh, believe me, he has approval over everything, the script, the director, the cast, everything. But, you know, I was really flattered that he even knew that what I was doing. But, yeah, so It's like I say, the heart and soul of the movie are their experiences in these unimaginable circumstances. And I wasn't around for a lot of that, you know, because I have a lot of exposition to explain the whole thing. And then you follow these guys. I had originally thought, well, I'm going to have the whole cast over at the hotel on a Saturday or Sunday. We'll have a get-together brunch. And Francis Lawrence, the director, says, Cooper Hoffman doesn't want to meet you. I said, really? Why? He goes, yeah. He's afraid he might like you. I said, oh, I get it. I understand. I get the process. I respect the process completely, so I canceled the lunch. And I said, and by the way, tell Cooper, I guarantee when he meets me, he will like me.
It's true.
Well, it strikes me, the novel was published in 1979, and you would have been age-appropriate to be one of the Walkers if they had made a movie then. Do you have a character that you would have wanted to play made the movie?
They're all great in different ways. That's what's so good about his writing, is he makes them so distinctive. I mean, the bringing in the mother of one of the characters, so that humanizes him in a way that you hadn't seen before. I don't think so. I would be happy to have played any of those characters, but I thought it was my idea. I reread the book and I said, oh no, it's in the book, because I said to Francis, what if I never take my glasses off? Because I want to dehumanize him, make him as much of a cipher or an automaton as I can. Because when I was prepared to do a really severe military cut and everything, but when I put on the cap, I thought, well, that pretty much does it. I don't really have to do anything with the hair. When I put on the glasses, it makes him more and more unrelatable as a human being. And I thought that was my idea, and I was rereading the book. I think it's in the book that he never takes his glasses off. I'm not sure.
Well, you have a lot of experience playing opposite a character who has sort of covered eyes and a mask.
Yeah. Yeah.
Obviously, the Guyver. We're talking about the Guyver.
Yeah, we're talking about the
Guyver. Oh, I never saw it. And it's not because I didn't want to see it. Usually what happens is if they have a premiere or something, I'll always go. But if they just release it, you know, sometimes they don't even tell you. So, and it's always expectations. I have always said one of the reasons I think it worked out for me to play the Joker was right around that time they announced that Michael Keaton was going to play Batman. And all the fans freaked out. Oh, he's Mr. Bomb. He's a comedic actor, before they'd even seen it. Now, within weeks of that, they asked me to come in and audition for the Joker. And I thought, normally you have performance anxiety. If you really want something, and I tell actors this, even if you don't feel that way, act aloof. Act like you don't care. Because if you, there's a certain neediness that can bleed through and make people uncomfortable. But with the Joker, I thought, if they freaked out about Mr. Mom being Batman, how are they going to freak out about Luke Skywalker being the Joker? It's just not going to happen. And because of that, I knew I couldn't get it. I had no performance anxiety whatsoever. I just went in and thinking, I'm going to make them really sorry they can't hire me. And I just let it rip, and I'm driving out of the parking lot real cocky, like, ha! Try and find a better Joker than that. And then, of course, the minute they said, you're hired, I went, oh, no, I can't do this. I told you I wanted to play a villain that had never been done before, Two-Face or Clayface or, you know, any other character that had not been done before, because I thought, you know, my friend, leave it to another actor to say this. He said, boy, that's pretty brave. I said, playing the Joker. I said, why? Said, well, I wouldn't want to follow Jack Nicholson in anything. I went, oh, no. And that was the only direction, by the way, on the copy. It says, don't think Nicholson. And, you know, I wouldn't do that anyway. But like I say, that really turned my career around in voiceover. I've been getting these parts recently, like in House of Usher. That would have been a routine character for me in voiceover, but to play an amoral, sociopathic lawyer, just pure evil, never on camera. So I really have to thank Mike Flanagan because he thought outside the box. Yeah, he is amazing, this man. So talented, not only as a director, but as a writer. And then Life of Chuck. I mean, he, again, you couldn't find two more dissimilar characters. And now with the Major. So I'm grateful. I thought this stage of my career, I'd be like, you know, spending more time with a metal detector, wandering around the beach, you know, playing with the dogs in the backyard. And I said to my agent, I said, you know what? I mean, I'm not motivated anymore. This is about, I don't know, 10 years ago, 2019. I said, you know, I think I'm going to just sort of retire and just do voiceover. And the only people that objected were my agent and my wife. Because, you know, it's good to have me out of the house. But what a turnaround. I mean, again, I have to say thank you to Mike Flanagan and Trevor Macy. Because that sort of kicked off this, you know, I didn't expect to be this busy, you know. A Wild Robot, The King of Kings, The Long Walk, The Life of Chuck. Oh, and this Christmas, I'm the arch nemesis of SpongeBob in the SpongeBob movie. I love the title because it sounds important, and it's so not. The SpongeBob movie, Search for SquarePants. And it's the usual inspired silliness, but great fun. And if I do my job correctly, every child in America will hate my guts.
Let's hear it for Mark Hamill's villain era. All right. There are two people who wish they could be here. They're making a movie overseas, and they can't be here. One of the actors who plays one of the boys walking in this, Ben Wang, and director and producer Francis Lawrence. Let's watch a video message from them.
Hey, everybody at Comic-Con San Diego, Hall H. Ben and I are really sorry we can't be there with you in person, but we're on set on a movie that we're working on here in Berlin.
Yeah, what's up, Hall H? I was told that there are 5,000 of you, so what's up? Hi, you in the hat. Nice hat. We're very bummed that we're missing this, but you're in really amazing hands with our cast. I miss you guys. Yeah. These guys all feel like family to me, you know?
Yeah, and I think that bond really grew on set. You know, it was something that I've never gotten to do in real life, which is to shoot. We shot this movie chronologically. Yeah. So, you know, as everybody got together and met for the first time, you as actors were meeting for the first time and becoming friends, you know, very early on, and then going on this experience together. And the physicality of this job of walking, you know, sometimes 30,000 steps a day, doing these very, very long takes, I think really, like, created a bond.
Yeah, it was, I mean, we were in it, and it was sort of all for one for all. And, yeah, we clocked a lot of steps out there in the hills of Saskatchewan. I didn't know Saskatchewan could have that much elevation, but we sure found out together. And it wasn't just endurance, of course, it was also a shared experience. That's what made it so special.
And I think that authenticity shows, you know, I think to see the real bonds between you guys as friends, but also the bonds of you guys as characters, that was something that really drew me to the project. And, you know, your performance alone as Hank Olsen, I think, added so much levity to what is, you know, quite a dark, intense story, but also some really raw emotional gut-punch moments.
Yeah, and it is one of those things where as the walk goes on, as these characters grow closer together, what you see is that for them, the human bond, the human connection becomes just as important to them as food and water.
Exactly, and that's what really drew me to the story in the first place. It was the sort of camaraderie of these young men and the bonds they form and how they support one another and something that is actually a competition, and you'd think people would be more after and out to get one another, and here it's the friendships and the bonds that really drew me. And the conceit was the other reason that I really got into this movie, the idea of like what the long walk is and could you do the long walk. And I love these kinds of stories where you as the audience can start to put yourselves in the character's shoes and think to yourself, could I do it? Could I do the long walk? Could I walk for that long over 3 miles per hour? You know, how far could I go if I were to do it? And that's the question we want to ask you, Hall H, is how far could you go? Do you think you could do the long walk? But before you answer, Ben and I are sending you something, a little gift from all of us, all of you guys down there too. Here are the first 22 minutes of the long walk.
Holy shit.
Yeah. That's not me. I'm not the first 22 minutes. But we do have to give you a little disclaimer for all the young ones out there. This is an intense, sometimes harsh, harrowing story.
Hard bark.
Wait, Velvet, you might. My daughter's here right now. My daughter's here. She's four. Velvet, hi. If you're in here, can you walk out of the room? And my wife, too. Well, I love you guys so much. I love all of you, by the way.
I just have to point out that I don't walk at all. I ride in a Jeep the whole movie.
You can watch a few minutes of it.
I have the best part.
So, it's good to be the king.
It is, yeah.
For worried parents out there, we've been asked to convey, this is an intense movie, but Hall H is an all-ages show. So there are a few moments that are especially harrowing where it might cut to black. Those who are worried, like, oh, did they boulderize the story? Like, don't worry. When you see the movie on September 12th, all of the things that you don't get to see here will be in the movie. But parents, it's intense still, but you don't have to worry about anything too far. They've...
Just some curse
words.
And you saw the Red Band trailer. You already saw Mark with his filthy mouth.
Yes.
Dropping that F-bomb.
Velvet, you can stay.
So some curse words, earmuffs for the little ones, and I think that should be about it, yeah?
That's it, and we're going to be gone when the clip ends, so please, let's hear it for the cast and creators of The Long Walk.
Thank you.
Thank you for welcoming Eric and I. If you're into Stephen King, please check out the King cast. And... let's roll the clip.
All right, so that was the panel. Of the part that you didn't hear, they wouldn't let us, and we probably wouldn't have wanted to subject it to you anyway, is the first 20 minutes of The Long Walk was screened. And most of the actors actually sat around and watched it. They hadn't seen any bit of the movie with the crowd, so they, and I think some of them hadn't even seen this footage cut together. But if you've seen the movie, it was pretty much everything up until the title card, which comes in a little bit late and after a particularly gory moment. So they sat around and watched that, and then we all kind of went upstairs back up to the green room, which is kind of this big area where they get all the people and panelists for the stuff that's about to happen going on. Like Jeff Bridges was up there for the Tron panel a little bit later, and all the people from the Predator panel were leaving there as we were getting there. So it's kind of this hustle and bustle, noisy room, which of course is the best place to sit down and try to record some audio. But chaos reigned, and we got what we got. And as you're going to hear, this thing kind of starts off in media res, as the film students say, as Mark Hamill is telling a story about method acting advice he was giving to one of the kids on the long walk, which then spins off into a bunch of Star Wars stories. You know, once you get Mark Hamill going, you just kind of sit back and let him do his thing, and he gives some gold here. Yes, we do hear from David Johnson. We hear from Roy Lee. Matter of fact, I think Roy spills he's working on some new Dead Zone thing, which I didn't hear at the moment, but I probably should have. And jumped in with both feet and kind of grilled him on that. But you're going to hear from everybody. But like kind of at the beginning, Mark's kind of holding court, and we just kind of started the recorder and ran with it. You are going to get a bunch of King talk. You're going to hear some wild stories from Mark, lots of Star Wars stories, but also some really interesting Stephen King stuff, including the fact that Empire Strikes Back was shooting at the same studio that Kubrick was filming The Shining at. And yeah, I'll let him tell all that story. Needless to say, it's a kind of a fun little like wind down. Everybody's really excited about how the footage was received, how the panel went, and we got to talk about some Stephen King stuff. So enjoy the chaotic, noisy recording that you're about to hear. I think everybody can be heard enough. I think I'm probably the lowest on the recording, but you know what? You don't need to hear my voice. You hear it all the goddamn time. So enjoy this chat, and we'll be back after.
And I said, no, I totally understand your process, but I want to tell you a story. When they were making Marathon Man, Laurence Olivier was sitting in the makeup chair, and Dustin Hoffman came in.
Yes.
Stubble, dark circles, smoking. It was Dustin. You're dreadful.
He said, I've been up for like 48 hours and
method acting,
chain smoking and nonstop drinking coffee, and I saw I'd be ready to play the part. He said, oh, my dear boy, you really must try acting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lord's
and living. I was telling that to him, not to comment on his process, but just to show the difference between British actors and American actors. Alec Guinness told me, he said, we were supposed to start shooting The Man in the White Suit on a Monday. Thursday, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I was terrified. He said, I had a thought. I said, I'll call my friend who's a dentist. Can you see me on a Saturday, Sunday? They said, yeah. And he fit him with a pair of veneers. Not big buck teeth, just veneers. And Guinness put them in. This is Wilberforce. And he looked in the mirror and goes, ah, that's my character. Just a pair of veneers. It just illustrates the difference between an American actor and trying to find, you know, method, you know, yeah, find experiences the they can experience. Relate to internal out as opposed to
like Chekhovian.
Letting the hat or the costume define who you are.
Didn't you say, I think you told me once in an interview that that he was very interested in what you were doing. He was interested in the young actors. Right? You wanted to pick his brain about the lady killers and all different
exactly.
things.
Exactly. So he took me out to lunch before we started shooting just to get to know me, which, again, shows you what a generous person
he was.
No,
wait.
But, and I kept calling him Sir Alec. Sir Alec. And he did this to me.
You.
what? I want to be known by my name, not my accolade. And I immediately said, so can I call you Big Al? He laughed, and I thought, that's a good thing, because I could make him laugh. And that's he amazing. Loved the irreverent American humor, you know, because that's just the way we are. We're brash, and we say what's on our mind. And that was perfect, because it got me over, because I was like he said, all I want to talk is about the Lavender Hill Mob, the Bridge on the River.
I mean,
he was like one of the greatest actors ever. And I've seen all of this stuff, and he goes, no, I want to hear about your career. Oh, you want to hear about a dog food commercial and my 9 months on a soap opera? I mean, really, because I've done nothing that he would have seen.
I heard he was a Mel Brooks fan.
He loved it.
He was great in Murder by Death.
Yeah. Murder by Death is amazing. Yeah,
I have a 35mm print of that movie.
You do?
I do. I grew up loving that one. I love Clue, too.
Cleaned it out as a kid. Like, I love Murder by Death.
Have you ever seen this movie, Murder by Death?
I haven't seen that one, no.
But Clue I've seen. Plays a blind butler.
It's a Neil Simon screenplay, and every character is modeled after famous cinematic detectives.
Oh, I love
like
this.
Nick and Nora Charles. They're represented.
Agatha Christie.
Yeah,
the comparison is like
Peter Sellers plays.
It's like that type of movie.
Charlie Chan.
Yeah, Charlie Chan. There's Peter Sellers. It's a great cast, and of course, it's
Jesus.
Peter Falk is sort of a Sam Scales.
Yeah, exactly.
You're on the record.
I was trashing a movie, and I never do that publicly. So,
what would Alec Guinness make of Comic-Con?
I don't know. I mean, he was a really shy person. I don't think he would be someone that would wander the floor. But you know, he was a great guy. I mean, we corresponded by letters. He would send me beautifully written, like calligraphy, pen and ink. You know, where the letters get thin and thick. One time I went over to do, I was only there for like 4 days just to do promo, and I got a letter saying, how dare you visit the UK and not contact me. Yikes. He lived out in the country.
What do you think Stephen King would make out of him?
Well, he was here.
Has he been here in person?
No. I don't think so.
That video was so cool that they played before the panel. Yeah. I loved that.
Robin, have you not seen that?
No, it was amazing.
I wonder if we can get a copy of that sent to
sure.
us.
Yeah. I mean, and what's so great is, like, he can't help but just be himself and that kind of stuff. That's exactly, I mean, you're experiencing that hanging out with him. But, like, when he's come on our show, every time he talks, he's just the salt
so
of the earth.
Yeah.
And he comes up with these crazy things like that, you know, bark stuff.
Still that guy who pumped gas or worked at the laundry after hours.
Right.
You know, he does have
email encounters with his role.
How many different movies of his have you worked on? What are some of them?
The one that's in development?
Yeah.
The ones,
any.
I was in
involved with It, The Stand, Dr. Sleep, Salem's Lot.
Okay.
Oh,
wow.
Doing Heavy Dead Zone and doing stuff.
Excellent.
So how did you know, Mark, you've done this, you've been in Hall H before, I assume, right?
Yeah.
Many times, and I know you've done like lots of celebration and all that stuff. But love is, this is kind of new for a lot of people here too. What was it? I found that when I went up there, this is my first time hosting something in Hall H, but I kind of love that it's so dark in there that you can only really see.
Yeah, you can't really see.
The,
yeah,
the vanishing point of people. Like, yeah. it's so big.
It's kind of helpful, honestly.
If it was fully lit, I probably would still be up there trying to find my person.
And these are hardcore fans. They know more about the movies I've done than I do, because they'll see 10 times. And the last time I saw it was when it came out.
Somebody ran up to me and said, who was walking around on our way up here today, and was like, I saw the preview and Peter Verbrugge's number is wrong.
Uh-huh.
It's 23. I'm like, trust me, I read the book. Like, there may be a reason to be a lot of different numbers. Like, but they thought I just got it. Like, I just fucked up. And because they knew more about it. Yes, there's 100.
Yes.
So we reduced the number to make it more manageable.
It's
less than 2 hour movie.
I'm a
no, right. No, and I didn't want to have to keep, like, it would have to be a limited series. But yeah, I don't need a, yeah, it was perfect.
Did you do a Hall H?
I did it last year. Yeah, that was my first Hall H.
Fede was here
with the whole cast. It was awesome. It's such an experience, isn't it? People... I just really love movies, and it's crazy.
First time in Hall H, first time in Comic-Con. I can't believe the joy that was in that room, the excitement. I to watch the first 20 minutes of the movie with such vigor, with the people so excited to be there. It was like watching it for the first time again.
The reaction to the footage seemed
really great. People cheered, and Mark came on the screen.
Yeah.
I cheered when Mark came.
I mean, that's the real lead-in, too. Like, there's no title card until that moment.
Cold open. Yeah. So cool.
Todd, what were your thoughts? Reflections on... What's your post-game on Hall H?
Oh, man. I mean, it is electrifying. And, I was a little nervous walking into it. I think we all were. But we found our feet. Yeah.
So was
we found our feet. And... like we usually do, we lean on each other.
Yeah.
And we're so blessed to have this story that's grounded in truth of, human nature and surviving, that, you just find the words naturally. So it's really cool, and the fans and the people just being out there supporting, really, really inspiring.
The only thing that surprised me was there's a shot from behind, because I was prepared going in to do a really severe, shave with just a tuft here. But when I put on the cap, it came down to there. I said, "Oh well, I don't have to worry about there." What I didn't think of is
the back.
That shave there. That's wrong. I should have at least cut that.
I think it's okay because the major also gets to sleep. Like, the major's different than everybody. He'd make his soldiers cut their hair, but I think it works.
Yeah. If you look at authoritarian,
they don't do
everything. The outfit's sharp, but very rarely.
Yeah, and he's a textbook authoritarian. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I ask you guys what your Stephen King origin stories are, since I have you all gathered up here? Like, it could be a movie, a book, we've got...
Yeah.
It could be, seeing a trailer for something. I know you're meeting Stephen King Martin's story, but what was the first time, Mark, that you...
Well, what would happen to me is we went to Westwood to see The Shining, and I walked right out of the theater to a bookstore and bought The Shining.
The movie brought you into his world.
Did.
Wow, that's cool.
Because his books are this thick, he can do people's thoughts, he can do background on the hotel, why it became haunted, there was a gangland slaying, there's all this detail that isn't in the film. But that's what got me started. I mean, I would usually see the movie versus the book's always better.
Same with Pet Sematary. I love the movie, but the book's much better. And that's pretty much the case with all of them.
Yeah, because there's just more time. Yeah. And he does nuance so well.
Yeah, I think The Shining gets a lot of crap sometimes for like the departures that Kubrick made, but I find if you read the book, it's a good companion piece to the movie. So a lot of the criticism.
That's
like,
one of the things.
Does Stephen King still agree about it?
Oh, yeah. He's toned down a bit. Dr. Sleep actually was a big.
Yeah, Dr. Sleep was cool.
Well, he likes Mike Flanagan. And if I had been able to ask him, I think one of the reasons, the only reason I ever heard him say publicly about what he didn't like about The Shining was he said that he wanted somebody that was all American like Ryan O'Neal or something, so you could see the degradation. He said Jack was pretty much
crazy already. Yeah.
Also, in that interview scene, that's the only time he's alluded to, but I know he was unhappy with The Shining, which I find hard to believe. The movie is brilliant on its own terms.
Kubrick also insulted the book and the rest of the movie.
He did?
I'm elevating this Pulp Fiction I think it
says Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, right? Over the top, on the cover of the movie.
On the poster.
The poster, I think, says Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, which is a little like disrespectful.
Yeah. On the poster,
it says Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
I also think they threw out Stephen King's draft of the script and Kubrick wrote his own.
None of that's good, but to me, Stephen King and Kubrick in their respective fields are like the same. They're both the very best. I'm still really happy the movie got made.
To show that he could bring a movie on time and under budget. When we arrived to do Empire Strikes Back, they were at Elstree Studios. So the back lot was covered with fake snow, and they were already like 4 months over schedule. Little boy, you can see his growth. The thing. I didn't know her personally. Carrie knew Shelley Duvall. Carrie, it was weird. She knew everybody. And we'd see her in the commissary.
Are you referring to Carrie Fisher?
Yeah.
That's so cool. Sorry, I just like.
They did a couple movies.
Yeah, I just like was sitting there. I was really like, listen, yeah, that's amazing.
Poor Shelley Duvall, because I saw Scatman Crothers just wandering around the studio, and I had met him once.
He's awesome.
Yeah, my friend was a cue card guy on a game show, and he said, "Hey, Vincent Price is here. Do you want to meet him?" I said, "Are you kidding me?" I rushed over to meet Vincent Price, and I told him the story. I said, "You know, when I was like 9 years old."
Did you just say Vincent Price?
I saw The Tingler, and it gave me nightmares for weeks. And he said, "Wasn't that a delightful bit of rubbish?" About The Tingler. Anyway, I saw, and that's when I met Scatman, because he was on the game show too. So I said, "Scatman, how's it going?" He said, "Well, I get out of the car, I cross the street, I go into a phone book 56 times. I said, "Wow, he does a lot of takes, right?" "Mark, I get out of the car, I cross the street, I get in a phone book 56 times. That was his answer. Wow, he does a lot of things. It was like a mantra. But I mean, when he's playing the groundskeeper or whatever, Shelley, if you can imagine having to be hysterical like that all day long for 30, 40, however many takes, she was a mess.
Drove her insane.
Smoking with her hand shaking, and I'm telling you, my heart went out to her. Carrie went over, and I went over to say hello, because I mean, I was really fascinated. I wanted to. His sets are closed. I didn't even ask to go on because
I would get
a hard no, so I didn't even ask. But I mean, really impacted her for the rest of her life. She was never the same again after that.
There's another Carrie who comes into play here, though. Because when you were auditioning for Star Wars, wasn't De Palma auditioning Carrie's actors at the same time? And George and he were like looking at all of you at the same time.
It was a cattle
call. You could have been the William Kent role in Carrie.
You know,
he could have been Luke Skywalker.
If only he had a better partner.
He tested for Luke.
I know.
And I looked at all the screen tests and I thought, it must have been eeny, meeny, miny, moe, because they were all good.
Right.
Mm. Everyone that tested for Luke, I thought that would have been a perfect choice.
But would you have taken Carrie?
That's crazy. Yeah, that would have been crazy. Changed the fabric of the
It was, World's Cattle Calls, when you go and there's no seats. You know, you're just milling about because there's got to be 75 people there. They were either teenagers for Luke or 35 for Han Solo. So we go in, and it's Brian De Palma and George Lucas. So Brian goes, so tell us a little about yourself. You didn't read or anything. You just talked. And wow. Mom, in the middle of seven children, blah, blah, blah. And after a couple of minutes, they go, okay, thank you.
Well, that's cool. No,
so
no
when you leave, yeah. I said, who was that little guy that didn't say anything? Was that Brian's assistant? They said, no, that was George Lucas. Now, I'd seen American Graffiti, but he didn't say a word through the entire interview. And my agent said, how did it go? I said, a lot of times you go, oh, they laughed a lot, or I got applause at the end of the scene. This time, I said, I have no clue, none. When I went to do the screen test, I saw Harrison. He had been in American Graffiti, so I said, Harrison, because we only got this one scene. We didn't get the whole script. I said, Harrison, is this like a parody? I mean, it's like a send-up, right? It's a satire, right? He was no help whatsoever. So I go to George, and I said, George, this is sort of like a stylized send-up of Flash Gordon. And he said,
oh, wow.
Let's just do it, and we'll talk about it later.
Hilarious.
Translation, let's just do it, and we'll never talk about it. So the thing is, what he does is he finds people that are so close to the part that as he sees them, that he doesn't have to go in and do any heavy lifting directing wise. He's really an editor guy. He doesn't like being on set. He'd go, action. Nobody would hear him.
But so casting's
the
a big
part. The first
day
he would go, action! So we'd hear. And George would go, okay, cut it. Nobody would hear him. And the AD would go, got it! So he's not an actor's director, really. But here's the interesting part. I did the screen test, and again, I had no idea. I said, you know what? The only decision I made that was probably the right one is I'm not going to be stylized. I'll be as sincere as I can, okay? The agent said, how'd it go? No clue. About a month later, you got the part. We're sending you the script. And I'll never forget reading the screenplay to Star Wars for the first time after I got the part. Because I figured in the scene I was doing, it was us getting to the Death Star. There was no Wookiee. It was just Han Solo and Luke. And I just figured he's a leading man. And I'm sort of irritating in the scene, so I'm probably like the sidekick. So I open it up. It says, The Adventures of Luke Starkiller, as taken from the Journal of the Wills, saga number one, The Star Wars. And I said, well, Harrison must be Luke. I couldn't remember what character I played, because, you know, obviously he's a leading man. And in the first couple of pages, I'm like, oh my God, it's told from the standpoint of this kid right out of high school. So I was shocked. I mean, and the thing is, the screenplay, even without the special effects or John Williams' score, was funny and great.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, are you kidding me? Robots arguing over whose fault it is? This is so beautiful. I mean, and I was like the straight man. I mean, you know, that little George going to get me in a lot of trouble. Oh, he says that. So, I mean, I would set up the line. They would get the laugh. Mm-hmm. But it was incredible. And effortless feminism. The fact that Princess Leia's right in his face. Yeah. She's not fazed by Vader at all.
No.
And she's disgusted with our rescue. You call this a rescue? Give me that gun! She takes over her own rescue. It makes us look like chumps. It was that good.
Well,
let them talk.
I'm going to be completely honest.
I think we're going to be interrupted here by this.
Hi, Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith is interrupting us.
We'll put it over by him.
Yeah, for sure. Look, I'm going to be completely honest. The first Stephen King book for me was A Long Walk.
Oh.
Which is
amazing.
Yeah, good way to start, eh? But no, I mean, I've watched Stephen King movies. It, Green Mile, all of that, but the long walk. Obviously, once I got the call for the audition, I bought the book right away. And I read it, and it was very powerful, very powerful. So walking into the audition, it was more of a, you know, I understand the story, and I want to be a part of this story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, the movies. I mean, the movies were your intro to King. You saw The Shining before you
right.
So, read the books. I grew up watching Stephen King movies first, and that's what gave me the courage as a young. I was in sixth grade, I think, when I read my first book, was Cujo.
Right.
And it was because I had seen the movie. And
yeah.
So I was able to, like, oh, I can read an adult book because I already know the story.
Yeah, it's amazing,
yeah.
And I'm so grateful, and again, I can't wait for the world to see this, because this story is, you know, especially in a time like this, is needed, you know. So yeah.
Garrett, do you have your origin story? You remember the King
thing? Yeah, I do actually. The first movie I ever worked on, I was opposite Kathy Bates.
Oh, really?
And I worked with Kathy Bates and Dustin Hoffman. And so I wasn't in Missouri, unfortunately, but that would be cool. But I love Kathy Bates. So yeah, right. She's a wonderful woman and a very talented actress. So I, at 11 years old, watched Misery as my first Stephen King introduction, and fell in love with Kathy Bates' performance, obviously, in the world of Stephen King. And then I was reintroduced to him when I watched the remake of Carrie, starring Chloe Grace Moretz, a few years after that. But now to be bringing a Stephen King character to life is it's the coolest moment of my career. And to be able to sit at this table around you guys and look at you in the eyes and know that we're doing something really cool, it's really meaningful.
Yeah. Hopefully the first of many.
I would hope so.
You kill it.
You know, in the book Misery, she chops off his feet and cauterizes his ankles.
Yeah. And chops off his thumb too when she doesn't like his writing. Yeah.
It's so much. I just love it.
It's great.
Kathy Bates is one of the warmest, nicest,
best hugs ever.
Mine's interesting. I guess I kind of unconsciously grew up with Stephen King. You know, my dad was massively into cinema. I watched Green Mile. I watched Shawshank Redemption. All those films without knowing it was Stephen King. The first film that I watched that made me want to research him was Stand By Me. And I guess I was always I really respected River Phoenix. And then I kind of looked at that film and I was like, wow. And then I looked the film up and realised it was a book. You know what I mean? And that then just made me go back and read all of his books. So this one in particular is, for me, a Stand By Me.
And JT, you've done the show, so you've given us our Stephen King.
Yeah, you've heard it.
Other end.
Oh.
You're talking in the butt.
Yeah, you've heard it. I read Carrie when I was 7 years old, and I don't know how I made it through. I think it took, I was in second grade, so I had a teacher named Mrs. Sakahara, who I found the paperback book at a bookstore in Ojai called Bart's Books when I was on a summer trip visiting my aunt in California, and I saw the cover of Carrie, this old beat up book, and I liked scary stuff, but I wasn't allowed to watch, you know, like scary movies, and so I grabbed the book, my aunt let me buy it, and I started inching my way through it. It took me like a year to read it, and I didn't understand a lot of it, but I got through it, and I would take it to school. And my teacher, like, got me in trouble. Second grade. She sent me to the principal's office because she said that. I mean, Stephen King was like having contraband at school. It was like having a porno or something. And yeah, and so they sent me to the principal's office, and my mom had to come down. And I'll never forget it. She came in. They were like, "He has this book. You shouldn't." And my mom said, "Listen, I don't let him watch rated R movies, scary movies, but I'm never going to tell my son not to read." And so she was great. And so ever since then, I've been a constant reader. And I share a birthday with Stephen King. And I've noticed that usually once a year, he releases a new book in September around his birthday. So it's become September 21st. And
wow, Virgo, Libra. Yeah.
Aquarius, sorry.
Okay. You're Libra. Yeah, I'm right on the cusp. But he, so every year I get one of his books around my birthday and I read it, and they're still coming out every year, and I hope it keeps going and keeps going. Anyway, Roy Lee.
Well, what year was The Shining released? The movie? 1980, so I guess I was 11. I'm just trying to think of the first recollection of being introduced. It was like seeing The Shining so I was 11 at the time, and after that, I was like obsessed with them.
Yeah, The Shining and like Salem's Lot is another common one. People like always remember.
It's so funny that The Shining has brought so many people into King Country, but he hates it.
Gentlemen, we have to wrap up, but please come back and join us. We'd love to talk more about Carrie and both Carries and the Girl Who Loves Tom Gordon and all of the five projects you have.
Many thanks to Lionsgate for having us, and of course to all the actors and creatives who took the time to chat some Stephen King with Brez and I. Apologies again for the noisy and inconsistent audio. There are a lot of people at the table in a very busy room with the audio from the next Hall H panel pumped in to make things even noisier. To paraphrase Indiana Jones, I was making it up as I went, and at the end of the day, you can still make out what folks were saying, so I view it as a win, even if Kevin Smith interrupted the hell out of us. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. The Long Walk is in theaters now. Go see it. It rules, and we'll see you back on the next one. Adios, folks. The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself, as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.